DW Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome. I'm Helen Sini in Germany. On today's programme, are Zelensky's conditions for peace in Ukraine at odds with the realities of the war? Ordinary men, horrific crimes. Could France's mass rape trial be a catalyst for change?
More politicians should seize this moment to talk about chemical submission. And there should be systematic training modules for the police and doctors.
And why Norway's electric vehicle revolution is in top gear.
I don't think anyone could picture this development that we've been through. In 2012, 3% of new cars were fully electric cars. August this year, we are at above 94%.
Не втомлюється говорити «Слава Україні!» Україна не втомлюється відповідати героям слава.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky addressed Parliament in Kyiv on Wednesday to unveil his long-awaited victory plan to end the war with Russia. Zelensky said the conflict could be over no later than next year, but he conceded that the implementation and success of his five-point plan depends on support from Ukraine's allies. I asked our Kyiv correspondent Nick Connolly for his assessment of Zelensky's five key points.
So I think to start off with, it's important to stress that we have received the public part of this, but there are still lots of things which are secret and which we haven't heard about, which are potentially the most interesting parts of this plan. So that's the caveat to start with. In terms of what we got from him in Parliament yesterday, it was a mixed bag. There were things we were expecting, like a renewed push to get a firm invitation to join NATO, talk of long-range weapons from the West to attack not just Russian troops in Ukraine, but also Russian targets inside Russia, far away from the front lines and the borders of Russia. But then there were also a few curveballs. So he was talking about, after the war, potentially Ukraine being able to contribute to European security, maybe even sending Ukrainian troops to defend other parts of Europe from Russia. Also talk of the need for a non-nuclear deterrent in Ukraine, so basically implying that Western countries should send their defense capabilities to Ukrainian soil to protect from a renewed Russian attack. Whether that would be after NATO membership, before, all not clear. So it was kind of a mixed bag and lots of new things. And I think there'll probably be some raised eyebrows in the West, given quite how broad and wide-ranging this was.
I mean, even as Zelensky was addressing Parliament, news was coming through that Russian troops had captured two more villages in eastern Ukraine. And after Zelensky finished his speech, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov commented that Ukraine needed to, quote, sober up. Now, Zelensky's not prepared to make concessions, it seems, but do you think his demands are increasingly at odds with reality?
Look, I think the Russian spokespeople are going to say that kind of thing, whatever he does. As for, you know, being unrealistic, I think there's been a dynamic all through this war where Zelensky has to ask for everything to get something, right? If you just think back to the beginning of this war, who would have thought that Ukraine would be getting F-16 fighter jets when even anti-tank weapons, let alone tanks, were thought to be totally beyond the pale? Who would have thought that Ukraine would have marched into Russian territory and held on to Russian territory for more than 2 months? That would be absolutely unthinkable. So I think there is a part here where, even if Zelensky doesn't necessarily think he'll get all the things he's asking for, he's trying to widen the scope and widen the kind of frame of reference. So I wouldn't necessarily say that, you know, he believes he's going to get everything, or he doesn't see the difficulties involved. He's just refusing to kind of go by the kind of very conservative kind of roadmap that maybe most of the kind of political classes in Europe and America are expecting him to take.
Well, I mean, for more than 2.5 years now, Ukraine's allies have repeatedly and very forcefully stressed their support for Kyiv. But it's clear that war fatigue has set in. And of course, Zelensky must be concerned about the future of Western support, especially with the uncertain outcome of the US elections next month.
I think certainly he's aware of that. He sees that. But I think there's also a feeling here in Kyiv that, as much as maybe Western capitals would want this war to be over in a hurry so they can get back to thinking about domestic issues or the Middle East, they do not want to see Ukraine collapse and Vladimir Putin pick up a big win here. So there is a question of, you know, being an uncomfortable ally. Look, people in Ukraine see Israel. They see Israel receiving lots of weapons and ignoring American advice. And you have increasing voices here saying, do the same. This is not Ukraine's job to make life easy for Western politicians. Ukraine here is fighting for its independence, its sovereignty. And they say, look, we basically, you know, did what we were told in 2014. We froze the conflict. We joined a kind of negotiating process in Minsk that was clear from a Ukrainian perspective, clearly not going to go anywhere. And basically that just allowed Vladimir Putin time to rebuild his army and then to attack once again in 2022. So there's a real reluctance there to basically do the convenient thing for the outside world. And there's also a feeling that when push comes to shove, even if, you know, Paris, London, Berlin and DC would want this to wind down, they're not going to allow Ukraine, they're not going to deprive Ukraine of the support to, you know, allow then Putin to make huge gains in on the battlefield.
And what about ordinary Ukrainians? Do you have a sense that they're prepared to keep going, or are more and more now perhaps thinking that, yeah, maybe it's worth making concessions to simply stop the killing and the destruction?
I think it's, in terms of public opinion and when you speak to people, I think the real distinction is, if we get NATO membership or NATO and even a clear invitation, if we get some kind of bilateral security guarantees from the US, as Japan has, or South Korea, for instance, then Ukrainians would be willing to think about basically freezing the conflict and staying, you know, along the current front lines. Then there would be clarity that, okay, the Ukrainian government controls these territories and that is it. NATO or America is not going to help Ukraine to regain what it's already lost, but the kind of continuing encroachment of Russian boots on the ground on Ukraine territory would be stopped. But if there's no such guarantee, if there's just some kind of vague promise to send some weapons, potentially if more happens, then many Ukrainians are going to be very reluctant, because they say that, you know, right now the West is forced to engage with this topic. It has its attention on this. But if this, you know, if hostilities are wound down for a couple of years, then the political attention will go. And next time around, maybe Vladimir Putin will be more successful.
And I was speaking there to DW's Nick Connolly in Kyiv. For weeks, the horrific details emerging from a trial in the southern French city of Avignon have attracted global attention. 71-year-old Dominique Pellicot has admitted drugging his wife till she was unconscious, raping her, organising more than 50 other men to rape her, and filming the abuse over a period of 9 years. The court case has put a spotlight on so-called chemical submission, in other words, rape using drugs. And the victim, Gisèle Pellicot, is inspiring others with her dignity and courage. Our correspondent Lisa Louis has this report.
This is how Gisèle Pellicot is welcomed at the courthouse in southern Avignon at the start of every new day of trial. Dozens of women gather to applaud her courage and grace. Also, as Pellicot has waived her right to anonymity and insisted on an open court, which is exceptional in a rape case. And so 49-year-old Justine has been able to follow the trial each day from Paris. Justine says a female acquaintance drugged her and forced her into having sex with her and a man in late 2021. She says the woman filmed the abuse and asked for 20,000 euros to delete the videos. When Justine didn't pay up, the woman sent the videos to some of her friends and neighbours. Justine still doesn't feel safe enough to speak out under her real name. But watching Pellicot has given her new hope.
Gisèle is a shining light that's exposing a dark side of society which some are trying to hide. We need to follow her lead. She stands for the power of speaking out.
Justine's lawyer filed rape charges after the police had refused to do so, but her court case hasn't made any progress.
I'm absolutely devastated by what's happened to me. I have to live with this abuse every day. I go to bed with it and nightmares about it wake me up. But Gisèle has given me the courage to return to the court where they told me my case was on hold. I will not give up until they pick it up again.
Another woman, 63-year-old Anne, who was drugged and raped as a child by her father, who also filmed the abuse, is convinced the Pellicot case will inspire many in France and abroad. Anne can't use her real name for legal reasons, even though her case happened in the 1970s and falls under the statute of limitations. In France, rape cases can at the latest be brought to justice 20 years after they occurred.
This is an XXL Me Too movement. Giselle shows such dignity and elegance, and she's not tarnished by all the harm and abuse that she suffered, which is being exposed in court. She's become a role model for many survivors of rape who, like myself in the past, feel ashamed to talk about the abuse they suffered as if it were their own fault.
Anne thinks the trial is also highlighting that so-called chemical submission, rape after being drugged, doesn't only take place at parties and in nightclubs.
Chemical submission also happens in families, and often over several years, although it's obviously very difficult to detect.
Dominique Pellicourt's crimes only came to light by coincidence when the police investigated him for voyeurism in another case and then found the videos of the abuse on his hard drive. Outwardly, Pellicourt seemed like an average family man. Véronique Le Goysiou says that's often the case with rapists. She's a sociologist and research fellow specializing in sexual abuse at French public research institution CNRS. She calls this the banality of evil, a term first coined by German philosopher Hannah Arendt in 1963 for a book on Adolf Eichmann, one of the main organizers of the Holocaust.
Rapists are often people from all walks of life, who work, have children, and a normal life. What's more, Giselle Pellicourt is a woman who was unknown to the public and is asking for justice. She can't be dismissed as some hysterical feminist, and that gives her struggle even more force.
Meanwhile, Jean-Michel Aubry-Journet, a Paris-based music producer, wants to do his bit to give that struggle additional strength.
Je pense que dès qu'on demande à un homme d'être humble,
Together with 200 other men, he signed an op-ed asking for an end to the system of male domination.
La remise en question masculine, elle est...
All men need to call out our friends and family when they show unacceptable behavior. Otherwise, we are complicit in their abuse.
That's an attitude some lawyers should learn from, thinks Arnaud Gallet.
M'endors pas, stop soumission chimique. Ce mouvement vise à alerter pour informer.
He's the founder, together with Giselle Pellicourt's daughter Caroline Darian, of the help group M'endors pas, or Don't Put Me to Sleep.
La manière dont les avocats de la défense se comportent,
Giselle is being subjected to what the European Court of Human Rights has called secondary victimization. Certain defense lawyers are causing her additional trauma by saying things like she gave her consent while she was unconscious or even snoring.
His group has filed a formal complaint with the chairman of the Lawyers Association and intends to, if necessary, take the procedure to the EU level to establish stricter rules for French lawyers. And Gala is hoping for change on another level.
More politicians should seize this moment to talk about chemical submission, and there should be systematic training modules for the police and doctors.
Khada Khatem agrees there should be nationwide specific training programs.
Caroline, la fille de la victime, était venue me voir.
The gynecologist is the head of the medical center Maison des Femmes in Saint-Denis, just north of Paris. It's one of the few establishments organizing day-long workshops on chemical submission.
There are just too many diagnostic errors. When a patient tells a doctor that they keep having memory lapses, medical personnel should immediately consider that this could be a case of chemical submission.
But Jean-Christophe Couvy, National Secretary at Police Union Unité, says such specific training modules are rarely available for the police.
Courses on sexual violence form part of our basic training, but only a few specialized police officers get access to classes on chemical submission. These classes should be accessible to all of us, also so that we're up to date as to which drugs are being used.
Justine, a trained psychologist, has in the meantime found her own way of keeping her head above water.
J'ai pu bénéficier de quelques séances d'hypnose et de MDR.
I realized that hypnosis and EMDR trauma therapy were helping me a lot, and so I learned how to give such therapy sessions to my patients, many of whom have been sexually abused. By helping them heal, I'm healing myself.
The government has now agreed to revive a parliamentary commission on chemical submission, which could initiate a shift in the law and finally gather some official figures on rape using drugs. Anne is hoping that this could lead to an end of the statute of limitations in cases of sexual abuse, especially when it comes to minors, so that even decades later, abusers like her father, who is still alive, can be held to account. Lisa Louis, DW, France.
And for updates on the Pellicord trial and other news here in Europe, head to our website dw.com. I'm Helen Sini in Germany, and you're listening to Inside Europe.
European politics. It's complicated, right?
Luckily, there's a podcast that helps make sense of it.
It's called The Europeans.
Every week, we break down the biggest stories in European politics.
Can I disagree slightly with the premise of your question?
Go for it.
I think some European leaders may actually prefer Donald Trump.
And some quirky non-political stories you probably missed.
Vilnius, the G-spot of Europe. Nobody knows where it is, but once you find it, it's amazing.
The Europeans.
New episodes every Thursday.
Norway looks set to become the first country in the world to only sell fully electric private cars. EVs already make up nearly 95% of the market, and a self-imposed 2025 deadline to reach 100% looks likely to be met. In comparison, EV sales in much of the rest of Europe has been sluggish, and here in Germany, it's even fallen. So, how did the Norwegians do it? Our very own Lars Bavanger has more from Oslo.
I'm hitching a ride with Ellen Setov and Espen Wang Andreasen on their daily commute into Oslo. I did this exact same journey with them over 10 years ago, when few people drove EVs. Being early adopters, Ellen and Espen had bought a Nissan Leaf, one of the very first family-sized EVs. Now they drive a German, roomy, upmarket SUV, and they no longer stand out from other Norwegian car owners.
There's absolutely nothing special with having an EV in Norway right now. On the contrary, it's the norm, actually.
When I started using the electric car, I could always park in Oslo with a free charging. The parking spaces for the electric cars were always available, whereas now you can't find parking places for electric cars. And if you find them, they're like really expensive or not available. So there's a big change.
Now, there's one difference I notice right now. We're driving on our way into Oslo in the morning rush hour. Last time, we were in the bus lane, but no more.
It sort of felt like a superpower because you were just passing the queue. Now they have closed the commuter lanes.
Incentives like tax breaks, free parking and the use of bus lanes have been cut back as the carpool is turning fully electric. Some owners missed incentives, but it seems that a critical mass has been reached, meaning nearly no one buys a new fossil fuel car anymore.
I don't think anyone could picture this development that we've been through. In 2012, 3% of new cars were full electric cars. August this year, we are at above 94%.
Christina Bu is the Secretary General of the Norwegian EV Association. And yes, it is the largest EV association in the world.
With good policies and a clear goal, people change perspective. They often come up to me and say, I used to say I would never get an electric car, but now I drive a, and then they tell me what EV they drive, and they see the world differently.
So what have been the main drivers to make people swap from fossil fuel cars to electric cars?
It's definitely not that Norwegians are more environmentally friendly than Germans, for example. It's absolutely about incentives and tax exemptions, but just as important, has been that we have gradually increased the taxes on petrol and diesel engine cars. So these cars have sort of gradually been taxed out of business in Norway.
Christina Bu believes other countries in Europe could learn from Norway. EV sales have increased in most countries, but far slower than here. In Germany, EV sales in the first half of 2024 fell by over 16% when purchase incentives were removed.
People here in Norway really started going fully electric when the technology started improving to offer long-range luxurious models that were, in fact, cheaper to buy than their petrol or diesel versions due to tax breaks. In other countries, it is perhaps not so simple, believes Erik Fiegenbaum, chief research engineer at the Norwegian Institute of Transport Economics.
Of course, Norway has been in the fortunate situation that we have had very high taxes on vehicles in general, which made it possible to have more room to play with the incentives. And we also have a large income from the oil sector, which we use to balance the national budget. So we don't have the same budget crunch that maybe other countries have, where if you give incentives to EVs, you have to do less of other good things that you want to do by the government want to do, whether it's better schools or whatever.
Norway's roads are not only used by private cars, of course. Vans and heavy-duty trucks are still mainly fossil-driven. But things are afoot also here. Ingvild Kieland Røholt works with the transport sector at the environmental organisation Zero Emissions in Oslo.
We're around 12% for trucks, which is quite good, but we need to get up on that as well. But then we don't have purchase tax on trucks, so we have to use like toll roads and incentives to help them go. And we also are now working to build out charging infrastructure for heavy-duty trucks, buses. They are all electric in Oslo. What we're lagging behind is the vans, because we have lots of vans, but it's only like 30% of the purchase is electric vans. So we have a long way to go to get 100% of the vans also electric.
Electrifying the transport sector does have an impact on the environment. Here in Norway, CO2 emissions from transport fell by 7.8% between 2022 and 2023 alone. EU's goal to ban the sale of new fossil fuel cars is 10 years behind Norway's in 2035. That's too late for the environment, but also for Europe's car industry, argues Christina Bu at the Norwegian EV Association.
I think Europe as a whole need to have a strategy for, you know, competing with the rest of the world and especially China. And if European car manufacturers are to survive in the future, we need to work together. But in addition, each country, I think, can do more to speed up this transition, because Norway has shown that it's possible to do this really quickly if you have strong enough policies.
Ellen and Espen still own their Nissan Leaf and use it as a runaround in town. But its reach is not up for longer trips. Their new car, however, seems to fulfill all their requirements.
Would you ever consider going back to a fossil fuel car?
No, of course not. Not at all. And going on holiday in Europe with an EV, we have done that. A lot of people do that every summer. And if you do some slight planning, there's absolutely no problem at all.
Lars Bevanger, DW, Oslo.
Just a reminder that we're always keen to hear your feedback on the show. If you have any comments or queries, then drop us a line at insideeurope@dw.com. We'd love to hear from you. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Helen Sini in Germany. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Helen Sini in Germany. In the next half hour, we're deviating from current affairs and heading back into time to discover what it means to be a victim of a witch hunt. Now, whispers of witchcraft go way back in many cultures, but the conspiracy really took hold in medieval Europe and with deadly consequences. Today, with powerful figures like Donald Trump claiming to be victims of a witch hunt too, have the tables turned? Or is there more to the story? A journey to Scotland's stormy coast reveals why this chapter of history is far from closed. And our colleagues at DW's podcast, Don't Drink the Milk, have been finding out more.
I'm the accused witch, and you are the Waymaster.
Waymaster, yeah. And I ask you to take your place on the wooden platform so I can see if you are weightless or not.
Okay, let's do it. Am I a witch or not?
Hundreds of years ago, tens of thousands of people, mostly women, were murdered for imagined crimes.
He got it into his head that this wasn't just weather. No, this wasn't a storm. This was an attempt on his life and the work of witches.
It shows the roots of misogyny in modern society, and it's because 85% or thereabouts of those accused were women.
But the witch hunt isn't over.
We're still living in the era of the witch hunts, really. It kind of doesn't matter which century you're in, you might end up going down the same path.
People are being killed. People are being buried alive. People are being poisoned.
So how has the witch hunt transformed?
It's a witch hunt. It's just a continuation of a witch hunt. They want to silence you.
And how are we still connected to this chapter of history that many of us thought was closed?
History is usually written by the victors, not the victims. And it all depends on whose eyes you see the story through and who is telling the tale. Who?
Don't drink the milk.
Welcome to season two of Don't Drink the Milk. I'm Rachel Stewart. For those of you who are new here, this is the podcast where we unravel the curious and sometimes dark backstories of familiar things and find out what they reveal about our world today. Like the witch hunt. I feel like we hear those words all the time in the news. It's become a kind of throwaway phrase. But there's a twisted history behind it. And the less we know about its dark past, the harder it is to control its consequences in the present. We'll get to that. But first, I'm dying to know if our producer Charlie is a witch. So, Charlie, what's the verdict?
Well, let me set the scene again. So I get up on this big wooden platform. It's a giant old scale, hundreds of years old.
I normally don't weigh myself like this, but...
Now your position is off the floor, so you have a weight which is in accordance with how you look like. You are not able to fly in a broomstick.
Couldn't possibly.
You're far too heavy to fly in a broomstick, and therefore never can be a witch, because witches fly in broomsticks.
There you have it. Not a witch.
Huh.
So, believe it or not, back in the 16th century, one of the most surefire ways to prove that you were not a witch was just to be weighed.
But then couldn't anybody just weigh themselves and be like, look, I'm heavier than a feather, I'm not a witch?
No, not really. You needed official certification from a weighhouse. And although you'd think that would be easy enough, sometimes the weighing was rigged.
Mm.
But there was this one weighhouse in the Netherlands which gained a reputation for being fair and honest, for weighing people properly. It even got this royal blessing from Charles V. So basically, if you got a certificate from this place with your weight on it, it was your proof that you weren't a witch.
The person who came into the weighhouse had to be undressed and was searched by the midwife. The hair should be loose because they could put extra weight in or on their bodies. And they had to put on a white linen shirt and had to kneel down on the scales to be weighed.
And so do you think that a lot of people who did come here thought, I might be a witch?
Yes. Once they were weighed and got a certificate, people were very, very, very happy and relieved.
Because if you were accused of witchcraft and you couldn't clear your name, you faced persecution, torture, even murder. And about 500 years ago, that's exactly what happened to many thousands of people. Now, you've probably heard of the Salem witch trials, which happened in Massachusetts in the US in the late 1600s. They've been immortalized in modern pop culture. Think Arthur Miller's 1950s play, The Crucible.
Did you see Goody Proctor's spirit?
Never! Never! Stop it! Never!
Or 90s movies like Hocus Pocus.
Twist the bones and bend the back.
Here to decapitate American Mystic.
Trim him of his baby.
Here to decapitate American Mystic.
Give him fur black as black, just like this.
But Salem wasn't actually the first witch trial in the US. And it was also relatively small compared to the witch hunting that took off in Europe about 100 years earlier. From the late 1400s, France, Italy, Switzerland, Germany, Austria and Scandinavia, they were all sites of intense witch panics and institutionalised hunting. Tens of thousands of accused witches, mostly women, were tried, tortured and executed. Around 40% of those executions took place in Germany alone. But there's another country that caught our eye in the gruesome statistics. A country that, in relation to its small population, killed five times as many accused witches as the European average. A country which was home to some of the most infamous witch trials of the period. And where the whispers of the past are getting louder.
Today, on International Women's Day, as First Minister on behalf of the Scottish Government, I am choosing to acknowledge that egregious historic injustice and extend a formal posthumous apology to all those accused, convicted, vilified or executed under the Witchcraft Act 1563.
Scotland, 2022. Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister at the time, is dedicating her International Women's Day speech to people accused of witchcraft hundreds of years ago. Because this small northern European nation seems to have noticed something important that the rest of us might have missed. To figure out what exactly, we're going on a trip through time and over the North Sea.
Are you ready? Good. And vow, Tam saw an uncorsicht, warlocks and witches in a dance. Nay, cotillon brent new from France, but hornpipes, jigs, strathspeys and reels put life and metal in their heels.
We've made it to the Scottish capital, Edinburgh. It's cold, it's windy and kind of damp. We're following Juniper the Witch around the city. She's got this black cape on, a pointy black hat and she's carrying a broomstick. She's definitely giving witch. But what she has to tell us takes us far beyond this well-worn stereotype. Don't worry. Just now, we heard her reciting some poetry.
So that was Old Scots, and it's an excerpt from Tam O'Shanter, very famous poet by Scotland's national poet. Does anybody know who that is?
Someone did know. And, of course, it was our Rachel.
Robert Burns, obviously.
Yes, we have a literary witch right there. Here we go. Burns, yes. And it was about witches dancing, which probably just meant women having a dance. But that, in the political and religious times of that era, that meant that you were in league with the devil and you were doing bad things. Suspicious indeed.
It's often thought that most of the accused were healers and midwives. That was sometimes the case. But actually, people could be accused for all sorts of reasons. For dancing, for simply looking or behaving differently, or for doing things that other people, usually men in positions of power, didn't like.
Gellis Duncan, anybody heard of her? Gilly Duncan from Outlander?
This time, it was Charlie with her hand up.
Outlander was my pandemic indulgence. Don't judge me.
Yes, there we go. An Outlander face, that is. Yes. Now, she was a real woman. She worked as a maid servant for a man called David Seaton out in East Lothian. But she was also a very gifted healer. And she would do a hard day's work, and then every other night or so, she'd sneak out of her master's house at night, and she'd go off and help people who were sick or needy. When David Seaton found this out, he accused her of being a witch, which she denied, but that made no difference at all.
Once accused, suspected witches would have a confession forced out of them.
At the time, they believed that if you were a witch, you'd made a deal with the devil and he'd visited you and licked you and left a mark on your skin. This mark, which could be a mole or a blemish or even a freckle, would be pricked with a pin or a needle or a knife about this length. And if they found one that didn't bleed and didn't make you scream in pain, that was proof that you were a witch.
A mark was supposedly found on Gilas's neck, and her fate was sealed.
Now, I bet you're going to wish you had brought your brooms, because we're going all the way up to the castle now, so follow me, my darlings. Take your time.
After getting some of the gorier details about the Scottish witch hunts from Juniper, we brave the winds of hilltop Edinburgh to meet history professor Julian Goodair.
Hello.
From the University of Edinburgh.
Pleased to meet you.
This is Rachel.
Oh, pleased to meet you.
Lovely to meet you.
Yes, so welcome to Edinburgh, yes.
We want to know where this deranged concept of witch hunting came from in the first place, and how it spread so ferociously.
We're just below Edinburgh Castle, which is perched on its rock. It was known as a castle hill, and it's the open area where many witches were burnt.
Julian's written three books on the witch trials that gripped early modern Europe. He's also created a database mapping out historical witch accusations and murders across Scotland. And he tells us why this exact spot at the foot of the castle, high up on a rock in the centre of the city, was the perfect location for burning the strangled bodies of accused witches.
You know, the smoke from the pyre will be visible for miles. It will send a very definite signal. You should be tied to a stake and strangled and burnt for an example and terror to others.
It's such a chilling image. The smoke from burning human flesh rising high above the city for all to see as a kind of warning. Nearly 4,000 people were tried for witchcraft in Scotland alone, and more than half of those were executed. Across Europe, the death toll is thought to have reached at least 50,000.
I think you're just going down the steps and then up again.
Ah, well, there we go. We need the local.
Yeah, we've got a local guy.
We've been going up and down.
The wind eventually gets the better of us, so we take shelter in a nearby library, where Julian tells us how the European witch hunts really got going.
Well, the idea of the conspiratorial group of evil witches who are in league with the devil is basically a 15th century idea, and it starts to be invented by a group of writers in the French-speaking Alpine region in the 1420s and 1430s.
Julian explains that something similar to the modern word for witch starts to get used in various languages to describe heretics who were supposedly worshipping the devil. After book printing takes off in Germany from 1440, these ideas spread further and wider. And there's one book that really captures the public's imagination.
The Malleus Maleficarum.
The Malleus Maleficarum, or the Hammer of Witches. This was a book written by a German churchman and inquisitor guy called Heinrich Kramer. It's basically a manual on how to identify, torture, prosecute, and execute supposed witches. Pretty misogynistic and homophobic stuff. So, naturally, it was a hit.
But was it actually?
It actually was, second only to the Bible in book sales for 200 years.
Wow.
At least, that's what the publishers claim in the book blurb.
What, it's still in print?
Yeah, you can literally still buy this book. And if you're as obsessed with the idea of witches having sex with the devil as Heinrich seemed to be, could be something for you.
Ew.
I know. Of course, the idea of witches, of sorcery and magic, existed in many different forms around the world long before all of this. But the witch Heinrich and his mates were talking about was a different kind of witch, the demonic witch.
The demonic witch, and that's the witch who is in league with the devil, the witch who has made a pact with the devil, who has sold their soul to the devil. And that's a specifically Christian idea.
This specifically Christian idea of the demonic, devil-worshipping witch helps set the stage for the widespread witch trials of the next two centuries. Julian explains that there were only a few places in Europe that didn't get swept up in this murderous trend, like the Balkans, which at the time was part of the Muslim Ottoman Empire. Elsewhere on the continent, the Protestant Reformation added a new sense of urgency to the panic around witchcraft.
Half of Europe became Protestant. Only half. The other half remained Catholic. Each side hates the other side. Each side is convinced that they're good and the other lot are wicked. But because they're good and the other lot are wicked, they have to prove that they're good.
Nations and rulers were desperate to prove their devotion to God. And one way to do this was to go on a crusade against the devil and against witchcraft. And although you'll often hear terms like witch panic or witch hysteria, witch hunting was actually something highly organised and systematic. Witchcraft was a crime enshrined in law across Europe and prosecuted through the courts.
So it's really not just villagers waving pitchforks.
Not at all. And one of the rulers who really latched onto this whole witch hunting hype as a means of maintaining power was one young King James VI, son of Mary, Queen of Scots. And someone who got caught up in his crusade was Gilles Duncan, the woman whose torture Juniper described earlier.
Finally, Gellis confessed that she was one of the North Berwick witches. She agreed to their suggestions that there were over 200 of them and that they had cursed King James's ships on the beach at Halloween, speaking rhymes and riddles into the sea before dancing up the hill to the church and cavorting with the devil himself.
The North Berwick witches. Looks like we're heading east.
Oh, cold.
So we've arrived in North Berwick.
Yes, the bustling North Berwick.
Quaint and charming it is. Bustling it is not. North Berwick is half an hour on the train east of Edinburgh. It's a super cute seaside town with squat stone houses and cobblestone streets, sat atop the rough, rocky coastline of East Lothian. Cute with a side of brutal history. Because this is also where one of Scotland's most infamous deadly witch trials played out. The very one that saw Gilles Duncan and up to 200 others burned at the stake. So given how important this place is in the history of the witch trials, surely this is where we'll see how Scotland is reckoning with its dark past and why. So we set off looking for signs. Quite literally.
Off we go. Town centre beach, straight ahead.
No, no, but he did say turn right.
It's cold.
But very quickly, we get sidetracked.
Rachel has found Sugar Mountain, which is this adorable fairy tale looking chocolate and sweets shop.
Oh, I'm so excited.
Okay, I'm going to get some Edinburgh Rock, some tablet and some macaroon boats.
But don't worry, it does lead us to a clue.
I'll leave you one open. How about that?
Perfect, thank you. Do you get a lot of people here coming to do, like, witch trial tourism?
Witch trial?
Yeah.
Do you know about witches, like?
We're actually here to do a podcast about witches.
Witches? There's probably poor women who were accused of being witches in the cemetery because back in the day they were just anybody. You know what I mean? You had the wrong colour of eyes. They'd be just like, burn them.
Yeah.
Now, have you got a wee bag that can...
I'll pop it in here, yeah.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thanks, bye.
Taking the sweet shop lady's advice, we decide to check out the cemetery round the corner.
So we're approaching an open cemetery.
But sadly, there's no mention of witches in sight at all. just mossy headstones and the crumbly old ruins of a long abandoned church.
But then, we get a tip from an unlikely place. The Seabird Centre.
Hiya, a quick question. We were actually looking for information about the witch trials. Is there anywhere where we would see something about that? I know it's not a seabird question, sorry.
I think the only thing I've ever really seen out and about is further up the road. You see the white lifeboat building there?
Oh, yeah.
If you take the road straight up there.
Yeah.
Didn't he say it was between...
Oh my God, yeah, literally by the toilets.
Okay, so it says...
In the 1590s, several local people were accused of causing a storm which delayed a ship carrying King James VI and his bride from Denmark. And there's, like, quite a creepy picture.
Yeah, it's a bunch of deranged-looking witches, mostly women. Long hair, pointy noses, breasts visible. And they're wearing skirts,
oh, no,
they're kicking
a devil
up their
in
heels.
The middle, with massive wings and horns.
They've all got bare feet. And they're dancing around candles, and oh, they look so out of it.
They look possessed.
Yeah. I find it just a bit disrespectful that, you know, the witches haven't got anything apart from an old sign with seagull poo on it right next to the public toilets. So, I don't know, maybe they don't want people to know that much about it.
No nation really wants to look at the bad things that happened in the past, do they?
We've travelled a little further north to Dundee to meet author Zoe Vendatozzi.
And Scotland really, really likes to see itself as this progressive, sort of semi-Nordic country where we invented loads of stuff and we travelled around the world being amazing. But we know that Scotland was involved in lots of terrible things. You know, we were really involved in colonisation of different countries. We were really involved in the transatlantic slave trade. We made a lot of money off that.
Thinking about it, Scotland has often hit the headlines in recent years for positive, progressive stuff, especially when it comes to women's rights. They have a relatively high proportion of women in Parliament, at nearly 50%. And in 2021, they famously scrapped the so-called tampon tax, where period products are taxed as luxury items. So if the country's got a pretty good track record today, why keep raking over the past?
We need to know about the difficult things that happened in history so that we're a better nation, so we're better people.
Talking about these difficult things is one of the main reasons that Zoe launched the Witches of Scotland campaign, together with barrister Claire Mitchell. They want justice for the accused witches, public awareness, proper memorial sites, and official acknowledgement. Yep, it was pressure from their campaign which led to that recent apology in the Scottish Parliament.
It was injustice on a colossal scale, driven at least in part by misogyny in its most literal sense, hatred of women.
The pardon, in this the speech, then-Scottish Premier Nicola Sturgeon drew a direct connection between that past violent injustice and the struggles of women today, from everyday sexism to financial inequality or even physical danger.
Of course, the lives of women are still blighted each and every day by an epidemic of harassment, abuse, threats and violence. An epidemic that seems to be getting worse, not better. That problem is real and it is very current. But the misogyny that motivates it is age old.
The image of the witch has morphed over time. Of course, nowadays, plenty of people proudly identify as witches. So it means different things to different people. But what about the witch hunt?
This trial is a total witch hunt.
The entire thing has been a witch hunt.
It's a witch hunt. That's all it is.
A witch hunt, as I call it.
It's a witch hunt. It's just a continuation of a witch hunt. They want to silence you.
You're talking about the witch hunt? Is that what you mean?
Russian witch hunt.
As a continuation of the greatest witch hunt of all time.
It's a witch hunt in the truest sense of the word.
You know, I call it a witch hunt. And it is a witch hunt.
Hundreds of years on from the European and Salem trials, witch hunt has become a common catchphrase for powerful people who think they're being treated unfairly. Most of them male, many of them politicians. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, ex-South African President Jacob Zuma, and many former US presidents like Bill Clinton and Richard Nixon. Although none quite so loud as Donald Trump, who between 2017 and 2021 tweeted the words witch hunt 379 times, basically once or twice a week.
There's no victim except me. I'm the victim here. There's no victim. There's no victim whatsoever. This is just a witch hunt.
In Trump's case, he's currently involved in a litany of legal battles, all of which he sees as unjust. And in July 2024, there was also an attempt on his life. But he still doesn't seem to have much in common with people targeted in the original witch hunts.
And he really has the profile of a witch hunter, doesn't he? You know, he's male, he's powerful, he's a central figure in government. He aligns himself with certain aspects of the Christian right. These are all positions that you imagine a witch hunter to occupy. But he does repeat his claim that he is, in fact, the victim of a witch hunt.
The tables have turned. That's Marion Gibson, by the way. She has the seriously cool job title of Professor of Renaissance and Magical Literatures at the University of Exeter in the UK. Her book, Witch Hunt, A History in 13 Trials, maps witch hunting all the way from the Middle Ages up to this modern twist on the term. And she explains that it's been used all along the political spectrum.
You know, it's used as far back as the 1950s. People might have come across the idea of the communist or anti-communist, rather, witch hunts of the 1950s in America. So ever since then, I think Americans have been kind of primed to use the idea of the witch hunt in political contexts.
And now people at the very top of politics, it seems like they're kind of weaponizing this very real historical term, right?
Yeah. And this whole thing is even more jarring when you consider one vital part of the story that we haven't even got to yet.
All around the world, people are still on trial for witchcraft, you know, whether that's in Indonesia or Nepal or Southern Africa. Hundreds and hundreds of people are on trial for witchcraft, and many of those are murdered.
These are real victims of real witch hunts. And they do have a lot in common with those original victims from hundreds of years ago. Vulnerable outsiders, people struggling to explain extreme hardship and misfortune, and falling victim to conspiracies.
The Middle Ages in Europe was not a happy time. Not only was there religious conflict, but there was also famine, there was plague. And it's also been described as an era when the Little Ice Age, as it's sometimes called, is kicking off. So the climate is more unpredictable.
Conflict, pandemics, extreme weather. Sound familiar?
I do think there are similarities. It's about the social conditions in which these things happen. And if they are the same, it kind of doesn't matter which century you're in. You might end up going down the same path.
And that episode of Don't Drink the Milk was compiled by Charlie Shield and Rachel Stewart. You can listen to a longer expose on those witches and other episodes by checking out the show on your favourite podcast provider. As is indeed the case with Inside Europe. That's all we've time for. Sound engineer Ziad Abu Sleiman was riding the faders in the studio this week. And I'm Helen Sini. Thanks for joining me. And auf Wiedersehen from DW in Bonn, Germany.